Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Kim Dinan, author of the memoir, The Yellow Envelope, One Gift, Three Rules, and A Life-Changing Journey Around the World. She has backpacked to over 25 countries on 5 continents. Her love of the outdoors landed her a coveted job on Backpacker Magazine's Get Out More tour and has compelled her to climb mountains in the Himalayas, raft frigid rivers in Patagonia, and walk 550 miles across Spain on her own. Her writing has appeared in Parks and Recreation Magazine, Northwest Travel Magazine, Trailer Life Magazine, Go Explore, and On Track Magazine, among others. Her popular blog, So Many Places, was named one of the best outdoor blogs by USA Today and has been featured online by such sites as Huffington Post and BuzzFeed. Kim joined me today to talk about the difference between querying fiction and nonfiction and her need to write that started with a blog and culminated with a memoir. You have a popular travel blog that began when, in your 20s, you discovered that a mortgage, a house, and a regular 9-to-5 was not making you happy. You dropped everything, quit your job, sold the house and car, and decided to travel the world. So tell us how this adventure turned into a memoir.
Well, there were two reasons. I mean, first of all, I had always dreamed of traveling, but I never really had the opportunity or the means to do it. Here I was finally in a position where maybe I could do some traveling, but then didn't have any time because I had a full-time job. And then the other was that I wanted to write and do some writing. So while I didn't like really set out on this trip thinking that a memoir would come from it, in the back of my mind, I sort of hoped that I would have a book to write someday. I remember this quote, "You shouldn't sit down to write until you first stood up to live." And I felt like I hadn't done much living in my life and I better get to it.
Was your blog something that you were working on while traveling? And was it intended for a large audience or was it mostly for family and friends back home?
So I started my blog to kind of have a space where I could water the seeds of my dream, I guess you could say. So what I did was I started my blog and I was writing about how I wanted to take this big trip, how I wanted to leave a 9-to-5 at least for a while and set out and kind of do everything I could to live this big dream. And so I started the blog as a way to kind of document that, as a way to make me publicly commit to this dream, even though I say publicly, but like literally no one was reading the blog at first. But then it just kind of grew. So I kind of found other travel bloggers who were either dreaming of doing the same thing or had already done them and kind of ended up creating this little community of bloggers, and people eventually did find the blog and followed me throughout my travels. I didn't have like this grand plan when I sat down to start the blog. It was just that I wanted to write because writing was something that I loved to do and I had not been writing for a long time. And then I also wanted to publicly state my intentions, and blogging kind of felt like a way that I was sort of working toward this dream when everything else felt like it was taking so long.
You're putting yourself out there and challenging yourself to follow through on what your dream was.
I had to do it because I'd already like publicly stated to the 5 people that read my blog that I was going to do it. You know, I couldn't be a liar.
Obviously, I want to talk about the trip that you took. I'm very curious about where the transition came in from being a blogger to becoming a writer, even though obviously you already were a writer. But at what point did the blog become something that could turn into a memoir? And did you approach a publisher or did a publisher approach you? Because I know that your blog has some pretty heavy traffic.
A publisher did not approach me. I approached the publisher and I went through the same process for every nonfiction book, which is that I sat down and I kind of wrote like a really ugly first draft of my book. And then I decided that I was going to kind of put that aside and work on a book proposal. So I wrote a book proposal and a query letter. And then I queried agents, found an agent, and then he sold the book with the proposal, which I make that sound so easy, like I just like hopped from one thing to another. But of course, it was more complicated than that. You know, they say these days that with nonfiction, like you need a platform. It's just like platform. It didn't seem that my agent was all that interested at all in my platform. I remember he made some offhand comment like, oh yeah, and like you have a blog or something. So it didn't seem all that important that I had a platform to him. I'm unsure whether my platform helped with landing the book deal and selling the book. I have found for myself, certainly now that the book is out, marketing the book, I realize how important it is from that point of view to have a platform of people that you can kind of reach out to. I think you sometimes hear with these huge, massive bloggers, you know, that they get book deals and people are clamoring to sign them. That definitely was not my experience. Relatively speaking, I had a very small blog compared to the big bloggers, but mm-hmm. I did have a really loyal following of people that had been with me from the beginning, and they knew how important it was for me to not only take this trip, but also try my hand at writing. They have been people that have really helped me promote the book. And even like now I'm doing this DIY book tour all across the country, and my blog readers are like letting me sleep on their couches and inviting me to their book clubs and things that I wouldn't be able to do if I didn't have this little community.
That's awesome. Blogging is its own demon, I think, in a lot of ways. I started a blog back in 2010. It's its own style of writing. It is its own skill set. It's very challenging, I find. I know I've had followers that have been with me from the beginning. It has slowly grown. I have a good following and a loyal following, but as compared to like the big, huge writers, bloggers, I consider my audience to be aspiring writers mostly. I know there are plenty of other blogs that have a bigger following than mine, but it's my home base online. Everything in my experience with publishing has to do with fiction. So I know that the process of getting an agent and selling a memoir or any type of nonfiction is different, aside from the query letter, is different. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that process is like?
And let me just state that I had no idea what I was getting into. I was just like, okay, I'm going to write a book now. So let me figure out how this process works. So I did write a draft of the book, but it was so ugly. You wouldn't even show your mother kind of draft. I just kind of put everything down on paper. And that didn't take me very long because, you know, it wasn't pretty. I called it like brain vomit. Then what I did was a friend actually who had sold a memoir, she told me, this woman was another blogger, and she said, you know, you should really start focusing on your book proposal now, because you can spend as much time as you want, make your book as beautiful as you want, but it's likely that your editor, or when they go to sell the book, the publisher is going to want you to make some changes. Why waste your time writing something that you're going to have to rewrite when you can just start working on the proposal? I had heard that memoir is a gray area. Fiction, you have to have the entire book finished. And then nonfiction, you always sell on a proposal. Memoir, some say you need the entire book written and others say you can just sell on a proposal. But I obviously decided to go the proposal route. I literally bought a book called How to Write a Book Proposal. And I just sat down and I followed it step by step. You write an overview and you come up with chapter summaries and you have like a market analysis and a bio and you talk a little bit about your platform. And then you include a couple of sample chapters. I think I included 3 sample chapters. And so I spent a lot of time really polishing those. Set the book proposal aside and wrote the query letter. Again, I just think I Googled, how do you find an agent? And I ended up on, I think, querytracker.net. And I just searched for agents that represent memoir. I spent a lot of time combing through that and looking at the agency, seeing who the agents represented. And I kind of came up with a list of my top 50. And I had read that you shouldn't give up until you get 100 rejections. So I was like, Okay, I'll start with 50. And then if these 50 reject me, like I'll go to my next 50. And so I just sent out the query letter out to the unknown. I was lucky enough that I got some requests for, you know, my full proposal, and I signed with an agent. Everything you hope it would be, you know, like the way you hope it would work, it actually worked out for me that way. And I know other people sometimes have different experiences, but for me, it happened fairly quickly. My agent that I ended up signing with, and I sent him the proposal. He wrote me back that day. It was a Friday. We set up a call for Monday, and then he offered to represent me after the call. Yeah, it was like a dream come true.
So who is your agent?
William Callahan with Inkwell Management.
How long were you querying then? Not long?
Not long. A couple of weeks. It's funny because I still have my spreadsheet. So I think I queried 30 that I, so I came up with a list of 50, but I queried about 30. 16 rejected me. I think there was a few that asked for the full proposal. Two offered to represent me, and then the rest of them just never responded at all.
I have spoken with other authors, and I myself have been through the process of having more than one agent offer to represent you. How did you go about making the decision on who to sign with?
He just seemed the most excited about my book. I mean, I knew Inkwell was a great agency, but really it was him. You know, I think he really believed in the book and he loved the story. And I felt like he was going to enthusiastically represent the book more than the other woman that I spoke with, who was also very wonderful.
I'm very curious about this whole process with nonfiction because it's something I've always wanted to attempt, but don't even really have a subject, right? So
that's how I feel about fiction. I feel the same. I'm like so curious about fiction, but I just haven't gone there yet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I hope to one day. The boyfriend is a photographer. I would love to work with him together and put together something. I have a weird fascination with roads and how they get their names. Because where I live, roads are, you know, everything's a grid. I live in Ohio. Everything's flat. Everything's a grid. You know.
Mm-hmm.
The roads are all named by, you know, county road and then a number. Kind of like New York. Everything's laid out on a grid and you can find things pretty easily. But in the communities, they're called something else. They're called by a name. The name is not on the road. But if you'd say to someone, yeah, it's out there on Black Cat Road, everybody's like, oh, yeah, okay, I know that road. But that road, you're never going to find that name on a map. And I think that's fascinating. Yeah.
That is fascinating.
It's just fascinating to me. People always laugh about country directions. And it's like, it's not even that. It's just this alternate naming system that we seem to have that I would love to discover where this came from and how deep the history goes. Why these roads are called one thing by the locals, but it is totally not what their actual names are. You signed with an agent, and then he, in turn, of course, represents you to publishers. So does he then reach out in a similar manner as for fiction, and he'll send a proposal and the query, et cetera. And then when he gains interest, he sends the actual manuscript.
So what happened was once we decided to work together, then we actually spent a couple of months working on my proposal. He was really involved and gave me a lot of feedback and make it as strong as he thought it could possibly be. And then he sent them out to editors. And I don't know if it was a query or if he sent the full proposal right away. I'm not sure. We had that conversation that I think everyone has with their agent where they're like, do you want me to tell you every time you've been rejected? Or do you really want me to tell you when we have some good news? And so he kind of took the lead on that and assembled a list of editors that he thought would be interested in the project. And then he sent the book proposal to them.
So did you opt to be exposed to your rejections from publishers, or did you choose to live in ignorance?
I wanted all the rejections, but actually after a while, I think he stopped sending them to me. Like, I think he's just like, no. I would be like, well, what does it mean when they say it doesn't speak to them? And he's like, oh, just don't pay attention to that. I'll let you know if someone provided actually useful feedback.
Speak to me is a pretty blanket traditional rejection.
Yes, which I know that now, but at the time I'm thinking, why isn't my book speaking to people? The whole process was, oh man, I mean, I can like vividly remember those days when the book was out with editors and what like a mental wreck I was and so stressed out. Googling like how many books that are represented by an agent, how many sell, and like, obsessing over a thing that I couldn't predict, which was whether someone would be interested in the book or not.
Yes, absolutely. That way lies madness. It's very easy to get sucked into that. I have had similar situations, and everyone always says the best approach when you're on sub is to write the next book. It's terrible advice because it is the hardest thing to do, but it is also the best advice because you can very easily go down a rabbit hole of Googling sales rates and percentages and stuff like that, and you will make yourself mad. This was when I was first out with Not a Drop to Drink, which is my debut. I had the list of editors that had the book. I was following all of them on Twitter rather obsessively, and one of them had tweeted something about she was grocery shopping and she saw the head of the imprint and just happened to run into them in a casual manner. She had recently read this book that she was in love with, and she pitched it to her boss, like right there in the grocery store, who was like, yes, buy it. And I was like, yes, it wasn't me. I was just totally waiting for an email within the next few minutes from my agent saying, guess what?
Yeah.
You sold. And I could be like, I know, I totally read between the lines on Twitter. It's like, no, that wasn't my book. That editor ended up rejecting me like pretty firmly. So you can make yourself insane. Once it's out of your hands, treat it as if it were truly out of your hands.
Yes, I think I will be better at that next time. But the first time, I just had no idea. I have found that the publishing industry works on a need-to-know basis, right? Like, if something happens, they'll tell you. Otherwise, they're not going to be checking in with you every 2 days. You know, I have since learned to just kind of relax. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it works, and it's going to move slow. And I understand that now. But when people ask me, like, what do you wish you'd known? That's always what I say. Things move slow, and there's not going to be like a ton of communication.
There's usually nothing to tell you because people are reading. I mean, that's all there is to tell you. People are reading, and then they're going to think about it. And then even if an editor loves you, they then have to talk to the editorial board. Everybody has to sign off on this book. So yeah, I mean, it's not an easy gig. That's for sure. No. It's not for the thin skinned or the weak of heart.
No, that's true. It's definitely not.
Up next, writing the truth in nonfiction, even when it's not flattering to yourself or others, and trying not to take reviews personally when you write memoir. Also, Kim's journeys around the world and her take on active motherhood, as well as where to find Kim online.
I want you to tell us about the book in general and what brought you to that point that you decided this is what you needed in your life and the experience.
It's a memoir, obviously. It's a true story. My husband and I, we were living in Portland, Oregon at the time. We had good jobs, lived in a city that we really loved, like really had a pretty great life. I just kind of had this feeling inside of me that like the potential and excitement I had once felt for my life and the things that I was going to do with it had just kind of disappeared. There was more to life and more I was capable of, and I wasn't doing it. That feeling stayed with me for a really, really long time, and I ignored it, and then it got stronger, and I kept ignoring it, and then I would kind of like manifest it as anxiety. And through this sort of mental battle back and forth, I finally came to terms with the fact that like I was going to have to do this. I was going to have to try to write, and I wanted to travel, and I was just going to throw it all away and do it. Convinced my husband to do that with me as well. And so we sold everything and quit our jobs. Right before we left to travel, we had bought one-way tickets to Ecuador with this plan that we were just going to sort of travel indefinitely. And I was going to take a shot at writing while we were on the road. We had dinner right before we left with some friends, and they gave us a gift. And the gift was a yellow envelope. Inside the envelope was a check and instructions to give the money away as we traveled. And so the book is called The Yellow Envelope. The entire book is kind of structured around who we met and gave the money to. The story is also about me kind of finding my place in the world. I write about my marriage, the struggles that we had coming to terms with spending 24 hours a day together and taking this trip together. Like, I kind of say that the book is about what it's like when a dream that you've held for a really long time kind of slams up against the reality of living it. Because like many things, I think even like writing a book or the publishing, like you kind of have this big dream and idea in your head of what it will be like. And then the reality is very, very different.
One of the things I was really curious about as I was reading the book is that you do a lot of soul bearing. You talk about your marriage. You talk about your relationships with other travelers. You talk about how you feel about your own body and even some of really big cultural mistakes that you made while you were traveling.
Okay.
So were you ever tempted to write yourself in a more flattering way?
No, I mean, I really wasn't. And I think that actually goes back to the blog, because what I sort of learned through blogging was that when you tell the truth, it resonates with people. Mm-hmm. And I'm a human being like everyone else. Yeah, I've made mistakes. I've done things that I wasn't proud of. I'm not embarrassed of them either. I mean, even like the troubles with my marriage, those were questions I had to ask myself. Those were things I had to explore. I can't be the only one having these thoughts and feelings. So if I tell the truth about them, hopefully other people will relate, and maybe it will even help other people be honest with themselves and know that they aren't alone out there. I remember when I started my blog, how terrified I was to even just say anything real and true, like put it out into the world, right? And now I just don't think twice about that, because it's like, what are we scared of? You know, what are we embarrassed of? Yeah, I mean, I know that there are times in the book where I don't come across as perfect human being, but that's because I'm not a perfect human being. Mm-hmm. Or at least I wasn't, but you know, now I am.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wrote very honestly, as you say, about your marriage and some of the connections that simply weren't working anymore between yourself and your husband. And it was very refreshing to read. I personally am not a romantic. I find it refreshing. I enjoy it because it's real life. It's the way it is. Yes. Traveling with your significant other for 24 hours a day for how long were you on the road? How many years?
3 years.
3 years. I don't know if my relationship would stand that, but I think it would. I think this one would. There are definitely others that would not have held up. That's a true test. I think it's very interesting that you even knew, as you say in the book, going into this, the marriage wasn't in the best place even going into it. And you were kind of looking for the trip to be a reset for a lot of different things in your life. And it ended up almost exacerbating some of your issues and then bringing it back around full circle and things being good. I found that very interesting. And the level of honesty that was there about marriage in general, your marriage specifically, it was really nice. I enjoyed it. I also wondered, at times you were talking about other travelers and frustrations with other travelers. Do you worry that other travelers might read this and recognize themselves in it? Or was that not a concern? Were you just aiming for honesty?
No, it's a concern. People I'm friends with on Facebook still. I mean, Anne Lamott says, if people in your life wanted you to write warmly about them, that they should have behaved better. Mm-hmm. I felt like I wrote, and it wasn't just me. Like, I checked with Michelle, for example, who was on that portion of the trip. Checked in with her about her experiences as well, because I wanted to know, like, was I just in this place, like having been removed from kind of Western society for so long that I was like unfairly making these judgments? There were two specific people in the book where, you know, one, she totally sort of had the same read as I did, and one, she didn't. It was different. It was my experience. And I think that I was probably looking at it through a different lens. It's my story. And so I told my story, and I tried to be fair. And I also changed characteristics, names and jobs. Uh-huh. And, you know, maybe people won't see them. Although there were only so many people on the trip. I mean, you know, right. Process of elimination. I don't think that I totally said something terrible about someone. It was more about my response to certain personalities or experiences where people were asserting, you know, their big personalities. It's hard to write about real people, especially when it's not all wonderful. Like life, you have different responses to different sorts of people and different experiences, and you're not going to love everyone. I mean, that's just reality. How do you approach that? Do you just pretend like everything was wonderful? And I didn't want to do that. So I just stuck to like my number one rule, which is like, tell the truth.
Well, and I think you have to when you're writing a memoir. Kind of in the same vein, when you read reviews, is it hard not to take the critical ones personally? Because I know as a fiction author, sometimes I read them and I become irritated because the reader will find my characters unlikable. And I can't imagine writing a memoir and then having reviews that are basically critical of you as a person rather than actually being critical of the book.
Bad reviews bother me, though maybe not in that way. I don't take it personally when they don't like me, because first of all, that's only happened a handful of times. And second of all, like, I just don't care. Obviously, I'm telling a story about a certain part of my life. I tried to tell the story as honestly as I could. I've read a few reviews that were very critical of me in particular, where I felt like they sort of missed the point. In order for me to sort of get to the end of the story, I had these experiences, and some were high and some were low. Sort of the human condition is to have highs and lows. You know, I learned something. I feel sometimes as though a few of the critical reviews have kind of missed that. You know, what's worse is when they just hate the writing. Like, that to me is even worse than they just hate me, because I like me. I'm okay with me. Do I really get to even call myself like a real writer? Right. Like, I don't have the same kind of confidence in my writing that I have in myself as just a human. Those hurt more.
I know that when I am reading, which I don't anymore, that's something that you learn after you've had a book or two out, that you don't read reviews, because there's nothing you can do. Right. You can't do anything about them. A good review just makes you feel good about yourself and makes you rest on your laurels. Yeah. A bad review just makes you angry and personally insulted, and there's nothing, you can't react to it in any way. So there's no perceived benefit to reading your reviews.
Like, I already stopped reading Goodreads. I even did that before the book even came out, and then Amazon, I'm getting there. Because it is like, what, you know, you write the book, you create this thing, you kind of send it out into the world, and you don't have any control over it anymore. People are either going to love it or they're going to hate it. And
obviously, you were in a position that not everyone has the fortune to experience. You were able to save enough money to not work and travel extensively for a long period of time. What advice do you have for people that have more financial restrictions on how to achieve smaller escapes?
Obviously, it's true that I was in a position that not everyone gets to be in. I also want to share that, like, it's not like we were rich. Five-figure jobs for two single people without kids, that was good. But we also sacrificed some things that other people were spending money on. I mean, we essentially did this trip for what someone might spend on a brand new car. I think that, like, one of these myths is that traveling is really expensive. And that's true, you know, when you take like a week long trip to Europe, but it's way, way less true when you are taking a bus through South America and staying in rooms that are $10 a night. I mean, and in fact, it's cheaper to travel that way than it is to live in one place. My lifestyle now, where I have rent a house and pay utilities and the whole thing, is way more expensive than it was on the road. So the huge benefit was that I got to take time off of work, could save money that way, and then take some time off of work. Although I was working, because I did start writing, was earning a little bit of money through the blog. And then my husband and I, we actually took a job for Backpacker Magazine about halfway through the trip. So we actually came back to the States and took a job for 8 months. And then that kind of funded the rest of the trip. I always tell people, when they have a big dream and they don't know how to get there, like, every day, take one step toward that goal. I mean, whether if your goal is to write a book, one step each day would be write a page each day. Put some money aside, even if it's $5. Make a decision. You cancel your gym membership and save the $40 a month. It took us 3 years to save for this trip. So much of it was done through small decisions, things that we went with that we sort of didn't do so that we could do this trip. So I do understand that, like, of course, it's not possible for everyone, but for many, many people listening, it's just sort of about what your priorities are. Certain things that we don't have today because we decided to take this trip instead. That was the trade-off, and we're good with that.
One of the stories that you told in the book that I thought was really interesting, and you might have to correct me, I'm not sure which country you were in, but you were using an ATM. You definitely hit too many zeros and you were like, oh my gosh, I totally just overdrew our checking account. And then your husband looked up the exchange rate and you had withdrawn like the equivalent of $5 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was in Indonesia.
An American dollar goes pretty far in some of these countries that you traveled on. So you didn't necessarily have to be swimming in money in order to have this experience.
You know, we purposely avoided very expensive places like Europe. You know, we just couldn't afford to travel to Europe. We did eventually get there. First, we couldn't go because we couldn't afford to travel through those countries. There's so many ways that people can kind of like work their way around the world traveling. I mean, there's wolfing, which is working on organic farms. There's couch surfing. There's house sitting. You know, you can volunteer to work at hostels in exchange for a free place to stay. When younger people ask me, say that they want to travel and they don't know how to do it, I mean, there are programs in the U.S. I think if you're under the age of, it's either 30 or 35, like, you can get a working visa in Australia or New Zealand and go over there and get a job. There are ways to do it. And there are so many people out there doing it. Before I left on this trip, I thought that it was like the craziest thing in the world, that no one like had ever had this idea before. And then by the time I got out on the road, it just felt so normal because I met so many people from the US and all over the world that were kind of on these slow, long trips around the world. And on a very tight budget.
So tell me about the Backpacker magazine gig. Hmm. How did that come about?
So Backpacker magazine, they have this thing called the Get Out More Tour. It's a sponsored tour where you get all this gear and you live out of a tent and you drive all around the country giving presentations about backpacking and backpacking gear. A friend of mine had like seen this on Facebook. She sent it to me and you had to like create a video and then do blog posts or something and send it in. And we were in Europe, maybe Czechoslovakia or something. And we filmed a video and wrote a blog post, sent it in, and then they liked it. So we had the whole interview process. By this time we were in Vietnam, did interviews over Skype, and they hired us. We flew back to the US and met the backpacker crew. They gave us all this camping gear and we just set off and gave this presentation. I mean, it was the most fun 8 months. We were in 47 of the lower 48 states. Our schedule was such that like we could have big chunks of time off around Yosemite and Glacier. And so we spent a ton of time in the national park. It's funny because when Brian and I, my husband, when we look back on this entire 3 years that we spent traveling, our brains always go to the backpacker time and not even to the time overseas, because I think we were just so happy being outdoors and in the mountains.
So when you say that you traveled the world, I know that in the book you focus on 4 or 5 different countries. Were there any that you have toured that are not in the book aside from Europe?
During the trip, we went to 25 countries. So actually, wow, most of the trip isn't in the book. I decided to just tell, you know, structure the story around giving away the yellow envelope. And most of the giving of the yellow envelope kind of happened within that first year. But yeah, I mean, there's so much that happened that didn't make it into the book at all. And it was so interesting trying to kind of decide what goes in and what goes out. I couldn't just talk about every country. It would have just been like a too much. The structure that I came up with when I was working on the book proposal, it didn't change all that much. So that was kind of surprising that I kind of stuck with what I had originally planned.
What was your favorite experience that did not make it into the book?
Probably I walked the Camino de Santiago in Spain, which is a 500-mile pilgrimage route through northern Spain. And I walked that alone. So that was pretty incredible experience. It really sticks with me. I mean, I spend a lot of time kind of going back to that in my head. And so I think that it will eventually make it into another book.
So you have plenty of material then.
I do have a couple ideas for another book, and I kind of keep a folder on my desk of some things that really interest me. I mean, my next idea is I kind of want to explore this idea of like adventuring as a mother. On the Camino, when I walked the Camino, I spent a lot of my time thinking about motherhood. Did I want to become a mother? Much of my time on that walk was sort of my back and forth with kind of coming to terms with, did I want to do this thing or not? And now that I have a small child, one thing I'm thinking of doing is going back to walk the Camino with her and kind of doing this sort of mirror image of what is like life like before and after, and kind of how do we carry the things that we really love with us into motherhood when I think so many women are kind of expected to give some things up. So that's kind of an idea that I'm interested in writing about. When something kind of strikes my interest, I have a folder, a lot of folders on my desk, and I kind of give it its own folder. And if the idea sticks around or if things pop up, stick it in the folder. And I've had a few things kind of marinating and they're ready to come to life, although I haven't really sat down and worked on the next thing yet.
At the end of the book, you're talking about having discovered that you are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Did you come home once you knew that you were going to have a baby?
So we were living in Mexico at that time. We had rented an apartment for, I think, 6 or 7 months with the intention of having the baby in Mexico. And then I did indeed get pregnant and it was like utter misery. Like I was like sick all the time. I mean, I was so sick. We were living on the ocean and the smell of salt water made me vomit. I couldn't have anticipated it, but I was miserable. And I was just like, take me home. All of those plans of like having a baby in Mexico and traveling with the baby, which may sound crazy, but, you know, I knew some other people that had done that and I knew it was possible. But all of those plans, I was just like, screw those things, take me home. We came home, been home for 2 years now. So right now we live in Cincinnati, which is where both of us are from Ohio, so it's near to both of our families. And that's been really wonderful with the small baby. It's been 2 years of adjusting and then working on this book and waiting for the book to come out. And it really kind of feels like, okay, what's the next thing now? I feel like I can kind of lift my head and ask myself that question.
I love that idea of walking the El Camino then as a mother, having a child and having the child with you for the experience and seeing the different experience, like how you've changed as a person and seeing this new person experience something for the first time. I think that's amazing. Are you going to try maybe some smaller escapades with the child first?
Well, you know, we've done a lot of traveling within the U.S. with the baby. I mean, I call her baby, but, you know, she's almost 2 years old now. She's been out to the West Coast, camping in a tent for 10 days at a time and backpacking on the Appalachian Trail. So she's done some things, you know, we just kind of bring her, take her wherever we're going. But she has not left the country yet. That, yeah, would be a new experience. But it's just like anywhere. I mean, as far as like how the world treats a mother and her child, it's pretty much the same everywhere. I mean, people are very warm and welcoming. And it's not, I don't worry about that. I mean, I have these dreams of like watching her run around, you know, the squares in Spain and playing with the other kids. I mean, especially the Spaniards, they have such a zest for life and family, and they're very community oriented. So I can just imagine like what it would be like to do this walk. I think that there's no reason why we can't have these adventures with our children in tow. And I think it's wonderful for them to experience things like this.
So you mentioned the Appalachian Trail. Have you hiked the whole thing?
No, it's actually the thing that I have to do before I die. I mean, I have been obsessed with the Appalachian Trail since I read Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, like when I was in high school. I tell everyone about this family right now that's through hiking the Appalachian Trail, the young couple with their baby who's just a year old, and they're through hiking. So like this subject of motherhood and adventuring has been on my mind, and it's been so fun to follow this family as they through hike the AT, because this woman is redefining, you know, what is possible for a mother to do with her child, and I think it's lovely. Like I always tell myself when I think of doing these big crazy things with my child, I'm like, you know, the pioneers threw their kid in a wagon and drove them over the mountains, and yes, like a bunch of them died, so there's that.
But, I was gonna say that.
But the fact is like that people have been doing things like this since the beginning of time, you know.
That's true.
We are so cautious. We've created this world where like security and safety is the most important thing, and obviously I think that those things are important, but I don't always think that they're the most important thing. Like sometimes you have to just take a little bit of a risk. I mean, you can be smart and still do something that isn't the safest thing.
To me, there's no such thing as an antiseptic adventure, you know?
Right.
Like if you're going to go outside, you're going to get dirty, you're going to get sweaty, you're probably going to get hurt a little bit.
Right.
You're going to be okay.
You're going to be okay. I mean, we're sort of like, those are the things that ignite our spirits. I mean, really, you know, you're never like at the end of a day sitting at your desk. I mean, even if it's a great writing day, you're never like, oh man, like I just really feel like I lived today. You know? I mean,
Definitely.
Yeah.
I feel really invigorated by my laptop right now.
Right. That beautiful glow of the screen just makes me feel so healthy and alive.
Right. Yeah. That doesn't happen though. I agree with you. I'm in Central Ohio. Been rainy lately, but it's been really nice. It's been really mild. If the weather will let me, I am outside as much as I possibly can be. And even sometimes when the weather doesn't want to let me, because I grew up outdoors. I grew up playing with sticks and mud, and that's what I knew. And that's what I liked.
Honestly, my happiest times, whether in this country or traveling, has been like those times when I've just been out and dirty and wearing the same clothes day after day and like physically exhausted. I don't know. That's what it's all about for me. That's when I feel totally connected with everything.
I enjoyed the section when you were talking in the book about, I believe it was in India, about the dog shelter and how there's just dogs everywhere. There's just dogs everywhere in India and they're all starving, and how that affected you and how you were like, I know that there are people starving too, but I have to feed this dog right now. And I was like, yeah, I would be the same way. I would be like cutting off my fingers and feeding them to dogs.
Yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking. when people ask me what my favorite country is, I always say India, even though there's so many heartbreaking, heart-wrenching things that you see there. But there's also just, I don't know. I mean, it's like humanity is like stripped raw in every sense of the word, you know, and there is obviously a lot of fights for survival. And then there's a lot of so much beauty and so much openness and just nothing makes sense, you know, because it's just that things there are done in such a different way than they are in the U.S. And it just like flips everything on your head. Ugh, it's just a feast for the senses, although feast seems like the word. It's like an assault on your senses. And the dogs, you know, for me, especially as like a serious pet lover, it was so hard to see that. Obviously, in the U.S., they are like our best friend, right? Man's best friend. Whereas in India, I mean, the cow is revered, but dogs are like at the very bottom of the totem pole, and they are so mistreated in a lot of instances. But then there are so many good people doing good work there to make sure that that doesn't happen. It's just like, that's just classic India, right? Where you just see the most horrifying things, and then you see the most beautiful people like helping out where they can.
Why don't you tell us where we can find you online? Tell us where your blog is and how people can find you on the internet.
Okay, so my website is kimdinan.com. My blog is called So Many Places. You can Google it, or if you type it in, I have little hyphens between the words, which FYI, if you're naming a blog, don't ever put hyphens in the title. Just for the rest of time, you'll have to explain why you did that. So Many Places. And then the book, The Yellow Envelope, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. It's in Target right now, but not forever. Pretty much where they sell books is where you can find The Yellow Envelope.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palombo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.